I saw through a rent in the canvas wall that though it was still night inside the booth, the dawn began in violet outside, and then I fell asleep. Now I was in hiding from both the police, for my picture with a wanted sign was posted outside the town police station, and also from the river people. I passed myself off as the peep show proprietor's renegade nephew. My new identity was perfect in every detail. I tailored my hair and mustache to new shapes and threw away my Indian clothes, putting on instead some dark, sober garments which came with my new identity. I guessed that in the minister's reckoning I was listed dead among the casualties of the war, and that was why Dr. Hoffman was taking such pains on me. But all I had to do was to hide in the shadows of the booth, polish the lenses of the machines, or watch my master arrange each day's fresh, disquieting spectacles, and listen to the various accounts of his former pupil's activities that he gave me in the evenings as we sat beside the stove after our business was done for the day. I was not competent then to comment on any of the information I received, and I am not competent to do so now, even though I have seen the laboratories themselves, the generators, and even the inscrutable doctor himself at work among them with the awful conviction of a demiurge. But from the notes I made at the time, I extracted the following unlikely hints as to the intellectual principles underpinning the doctor's manifestations. His main principles were indeed as follows. Everything it is possible to imagine can also exist. A vast encyclopedia of mythological references supported this initial hypothesis. Shamans of Oceania who sang rude blocks of wood ship-shape without the intervention of an axe. Poets of medieval Ireland whose withering odes scalded their king's enemies with plagues of boils, and so on and so forth. At a very early point in his studies, Hoffman had moved well out of the realm of pure science and resurrected all manner of antique pseudosciences. Alchemy, geomancy, and the empirical investigation of those essences, the ancient Chinese claimed created phenomena through an interplay of elemental aspects of maleness and femaleness. Then there was the notion of passion. In the pocket of my dark suit, I found a scrap of paper with the following quotation from De Sade written on it in the most exquisite feminine handwriting. Though the message was undirected and unsigned, I knew it was meant for me and that it came from Albertina. My passions, concentrated on a single point, resembled the rays of a sun assembled by a magnifying glass. They immediately set fire to whatever object they find in their way. Yet I could see no personal significance in these words, and finally decided they must refer to the machinery of the peep show itself. For I had even begun to believe that the manipulation of those numinous samples might indeed restructure events, since, in a poetic and circuitous fashion, they had certainly helped to organize my disastrous night at the mayor's house. But I was wistfully impressed by the grandiloquence of both De Sade and the girl who quoted him to me, for I knew myself to be a man without much passion, even if I was a romantic. If I once again existed only in the vague hope I would one day see Albertina herself again, I could not imagine this desire might make me incandescent enough to glimpse her whereabouts by my own glow, let alone to utilize what my instructor in hyperphysics described to me as the radiant energy which emanated from desire to blaze a path to her. An old blind man, playing with toys in a fairground, lost in a mazy web of memories of things he had not seen. it was a case of the blind leading the blind, for he could never have been a man who burned with passion himself either. So, when he spoke of Albertina as if she were lambent flame made flesh, his words rang curiously false. Although I could remember my dream of the inextinguishable skeleton, and wonder if she had visited him in the dream too, for he could only see when he was asleep. He had formed a loose attachment with the Fairground people, and so the old man, the carnival, and I travelled on together. I found that the peep show proprietor, anticipating my arrival, had rented a broken-down truck from the Armenian who operated the Wheel of Fortune. This was his new little old truck, and I drove it for him as we moved with our new companions from place to place, part of a tumultuous cavalcade moving towards the other towns along the winter roads. On the road, I was as safe from the Indians as I had been from the police while I lived on the river. I was as safe from everything as I would have been in the opera house listening to The Marriage of Figaro, because the road was another kind of self-consistent river. The traveling fair was its own world, which acknowledged no geographical location or temporal situation, for everywhere we halted was exactly the same as where we had stopped last, once we had put up our booths and sideshows. Mexican comedians, intrepid equestrians from Nebraska, Kansas, or Ohio, whose endless legs and scrubbed features were labeled Made in USA. Japanese dwarfs who wrestled together in arenas of mud. Norwegian motorcyclists roaring vertically around the portable walls of death. A team of dancing albinos whose pallid gavottes were like those of the luminous undead. The bearded lady and the alligator man. These were my new neighbors, who shared nothing but the sullen glamour of their difference from the common world, and clung defensively together to protect and perpetuate this difference. Natives of a fairground, they acknowledged no other nationality and could imagine no other home. A polyglot babble manned the sideshows, the rifle ranges and coconut shies, dive bombers, helter-skelters and roundabouts on which, hieractic as knights in chess, the painted horses described perpetual circles, as immune as those of the planets to the drab world of the here and now inhabited by those who came to gape at us. And if we transcended the commonplace, so we transcended language. Since we had few tongues in common, we mostly used a language of grunt, bark, and gesture, which is, perhaps, the common matrix of language. And as we rarely had anything more complicated to say to one another than how miry the roads were, we all got on well enough. They were not in the least aware how extraordinary they were, because they made their living out of the grotesque. Their bread was deformity. Their biographies, however tragic or bizarre, were all alike in singularity, and many of them, like myself, were permanently in hiding from a real world, which they understood so badly, nobody knew how much it had changed since the war began. Sometimes I thought the whole savage and dissolute crew were nothing but the Doctor's storm troops, but they did not know anything at all about the Doctor. Nobody had heard his name. They only knew a little about themselves, and this knowledge in itself was quite sufficient to create a microcosm with as gaudy, circumscribed, rotary, and absurd a structure as a roundabout. I often watched the roundabouts circulate upon their static journeys. "Nothing," said the peep show proprietor, "is ever completed. It only changes." As he pleased, he altered the displays he had never seen, murmuring, "No hidden unity." The children of the fairground pressed their snot and filth-caked faces to the eyepieces and giggled at what they saw. Nothing was strange to those whose fathers rode the wall of death 3 times a day, while their mothers elegantly defied gravity and taught a single leg atop the white back of a pirouetting horse. And they seemed to see so little of their parents, they might have been spontaneously generated by the evanescent paraphernalia of the passing show around them, which no sooner had it been set up, was dismantled, piled up in segments on erratic trucks, and shifted in its entirety to some other new venue. The fairground was a moving toy shop, an ambulant, rare show come to life in convulsive fits and starts whenever the procession stopped, regulated only by the implicit awareness of a lack of rules. First will come nebulous time, a period of absolute mutability, when only refracted rays and broken trajectories of an entirely hypothetical source of light fitfully reveal a continually shifting surface, like the surface of water. Yet a water which is only a reflective skin has neither depth nor volume. But you must never forget the doctor's philosophy is not so much transcendental as incidental. It utilizes all the incidents that ripple the depthless surfaces of, you understand, the sensual world. When the sensual world unconditionally surrenders to the intermittency of immutability, man will be freed in perpetuity from the tyranny of a single present. And we will live on as many layers of consciousness as we can, all at the same time. After the doctor liberates us, that is. Only after that. Toasting cheese sweated a few drops of grease onto the flame in the stove so that it flared and stank. I filled the glass he held out to me, watching as I did so the reflected flame splutter on the cracked lenses of his dark glasses. Sometimes he looked like an old blind evangelist. As he grew more used to having once again an audience, he altered his periods more and more succinctly, and phrased his lecturettes with more resonance. He started to impress me not so much with the quality of his discourse, as with the odd wonder with which he delivered it. He often combined prophetic fervor with sibylline obscurity. Since I always got up before him in the morning, sometimes I caught sight of him waking up. It was always poignant to watch him open his sightless eyes and blink a little, as if this time there might be a chance he would blink away the darkness forever. Thrust as I was into such intimacy with the peep-show proprietor, I could not help beginning to feel affection for him, and I found myself ministering to the needs of an occasionally incontinent, always foul-mannered old man, with a generosity I would never have expected of myself, although he made few demands upon me, and those were mostly upon my attention. My tasks were simple and housewifely, for he did not allow me to meddle with a set of samples. I assembled our meals, swept out the booth, shook out our sleeping straw, dusted the machines, and, behind a spare pair of discreet sunglasses, sat at the counter during his frequent absences in bars, for his drunkenness was real enough. Then I would make notes of the things he told me, and try to tease out from them some notion of the practical means by which his former pupil performed his conjuring tricks. Though this was a very difficult task, for the essence of the Hoffman theory was the fluidity of its structure, and besides, I was constantly interrupted by visits from the roving packs of children and their elders also. A clatter of scales announced the arrival of Homo reptilis for a bleak chat and several of my cigarettes, A whiff of gunpowder and imported perfume, that of Mimi Buckskin, the sharpshooter. While a more fragile and tentative clearing of the throat told me Madame Le Barbe was here. Madame Le Barbe kept her chestnut moustache to neat, discreet, vermeer proportions, and it disguised an uncommonly maternal nature. She would bring me a brioche, freshly baked in the oven she had installed in a French provincial caravan, full of plants in pots, pet cats, over-upholstered sofas, and framed photographs of her kin. On the frames of those of her relatives who were deceased, she hung rosettes of black ribbons. I must admit that all my guests enchanted me, and I, in turn, enchanted them. For here I had the unique allure of the norm. I was exotic precisely to the extent of my mundanity. The peep show proprietor's nephew was a small businessman bankrupted by the catastrophe in the capital. And all those freaks could not get enough of my accounts of the world of typewriters and telephones, flush toilets, tiled bathrooms, electric lights, and mechanical appliances. They wondered at a masterpiece of sterility I remembered for them, as if it were an earthly paradise from which they were barred forever. So I gave them an imitation of another reality, while the peep-show proprietor offered me far stronger meat. Proposition. Time is ethereal composition of apparently indivisible instants. Since the inception of the mode of consciousness we refer to as the world, man has always thought of time as in itself a movement forward, an onward flow leaving only a little debris behind it. Evanescence is the essence of time. And since temporality is the medium in which this mode of consciousness has itself been expressed, since time is, as it were, the canvas on which we ourselves are painted, the empirical investigation of the structure of time poses certain acute methodological problems. Could the Mona Lisa turn around, scratch her own background, and then submit to a laboratory analysis the substance she found under her nail? No, indeed. Now, this analogy, a striking one, implies that all the phenomena are necessarily temporal in nature, and roll forward en masse on wheels at the corners of the four-square block of space-time they occupy, shoulder to shoulder, and bearing always at their backs the wall against which they all must meet that shooting squad, mortality. Yet this model of the world does not make even so much as the formal acknowledgement of the synthesizable aspect of time as was made to space by the introduction of a perspective into painting. In other words, we knew so little about the geometry of time, let alone its physical properties, that we could not even adequately simulate the physical form of so much as a single instant. The introduction of cinematography enabled us to corral time past and thus retain it, not merely in the memory, at best a falsifying receptacle, but in the objective preservative of a roll of film. But if past, present, and future are the dimensions of time, they are notoriously fluid. There is no tension in the tenses, and yet they are always tremulously about to coagulate. The present is a liquid jelly which settles into a quivering passive mass. The past, as soon as, if not sooner than, we are aware of it as the present. Yet this mass was intangible and existed only conceptually until the arrival of the preservative cinema. The motion picture is usually regarded as only a kind of shadow play, and few bother to probe the ontological paradoxes it presents. for it offers us nothing less than the present tense experience of time irrefutably past. So that the coil of film has, as it were, lassoed the inert phenomena from which the present had departed. And when projected upon a screen, they are granted a temporary revivification. My student Mendoza offered me some investigations along these lines to justify the many hours he spent each day in the neighborhood free pits, gazing at the panorama of revived phenomena with glazed, visionary eyes. Once he remarked to me in conversation, Lumière was not the father of cinema. It was Sergeant Bertrand, the violator of graves. The images of cinematography, however, altogether lack autonomy. Locking in programmed patterns, they merely transpose time past into time present and cannot, by their nature, respond to the magnetic impulses of time future, for the unachievable future which does not exist in any dimension, but nevertheless organizes phenomena towards its potential conclusions. The cinematographic model is one of cyclic recurrences alone. Even if these recurrences are instigated voluntarily by the hand of man, viz. The projectionist rather than the hand of fate. Though, in another sense, the action of time is actually visible in the tears, scratches, and thumbprints on the substance of the film itself. These are caused only by the sly, corrosive touch of mortality, and, since the print may be renewed at will, the flaws of aging, if retained, increase the presence of the past only by a kind of forgery, as when a man punches artificial wormholes into raw wood, or smokes shadows of fresh paint with a candle to produce an apparently aged artifact. Mendoza, however, claimed that if a thing were sufficiently artificial, it became absolutely equivalent to the genuine. His mind puffed out ideas like the dandelion seedhead his chevalier so much resembled. But we did not take any of his ideas seriously. Not one of us. Not any of them. Yet Hoffman refined Mendoza's initially crude hypotheses of fissile time and synthetic authenticity, and wove them together to form another mode of consciousness altogether. But we did not know that. We were content to laugh at Mendoza. We laughed uproariously. He dreamed of fissile time, of exploding the diatonic scale with its two notes past and present into a chromatic fanfare of every conceivable tense, and many tenses at present inconceivable, because there is no language to describe them. He produced sheet after sheet of mathematics in an exceedingly neurotic script to prove to me that time was as amenable to the rigors of scientific analysis as any other notion. And indeed he convinced me, at least, that time was elastic, for it always seemed to stretch out to eternity as I read them through. A footnote. A pastel-colored joke designed to produce a discreet titter among freshmen, Desiderio. His attitude to abstractions was this. Abstractions only were true because, since they did not exist, they could be proved or disproved entirely at the whim of the investigator. How his wild eyes flashed as he spoke. By the end of his sophomore year, Mendoza was the clown of the senior common room. We looked forward to his essays, much as London clubmen look forward to their weekly punch. How we chuckled richly over our port as I read aloud the choicest tidbits. His classmates mocked him, too. Only Hoffman, with his Teutonic lack of humor, listened to the outrageous Mendoza with a straight face. In time, he and Mendoza became almost inseparable, though they made a strangely ill-assorted couple and together gave an impression of vaudeville rather than the laboratory. For Mendoza sported flowing hair, abundant neckties, herbaceous shirts, and suits of black velvet, while his gleaming, impassioned gaze seemed to warn one to weave a circle around him thrice before approaching him. As for Hoffman, he was a model of propriety, well-starched and stiffly suited, one of his cold blue eyes wedged open with a monocle. His handshake was moist and chill. His smile was alpine in its austerity, and he always smelled of medicated soap. He was already unnaturally brilliant, and even his teachers feared him. Mendoza was his only friend. They worked together and they played together. Soon we began to hear the most disreputable stories of their exploits in the red light quarter. Now, Mendoza had a streak of Moorish blood, and read Arabic fluently. He followed up certain hints from obscure books, and became more and more obsessed with the nature of time in relation to the sexual act. At length he devised a hilarious thesis concerning the fissile, tensile nature of the orgasm. He claimed that the actual discharge took place in neither past, present, nor future, but precipitated an exponential polychromatic fusion of all three, especially if impregnation were effected. He submitted to me an end-of-term paper titled, I recall, "The Fissile Potential of the Willed Annihilation of the Orgiastic Instant." It described an experiment utilizing the talents of seven of the town's most notorious whores, and, if it proved nothing else, it showed that Mendoza was something of an athlete, while his technical assistant, none other than Decorous Hoffman, possessed, against all appearances, quite remarkable sexual versatility. Mendoza described his results as the perpetration of a durationless state, possibly synthesizing infinity. He claimed their enthusiasm had set up such intense vibrations, every clock in the establishment burst its case. He submitted to the university bills, not only for the services of the prostitutes, but also for those of the clock repairer. So we dismissed Mendoza. When he learned he had been sent down, he broke into the laboratory and smeared feces all over the blackboards. After that, we heard no more of him. But Hoffman, of course, kept in touch with him. Indeed, it was the beginning of the first great period of their research. And so on, and so on, and so on. As he grew used to my continual presence, he gave me such heady blends of theory and biography 3 or 4 times a week, and various forgotten tricks of the lecturer came back to him. He often hunted for forgotten chalk to draw diagrams on a blackboard which existed only in a memory of the university, and bunched his fingers in an invisible academic gown. I found these gestures unspeakably moving. I filled his glass and listened. But none of these gobbets and scraps issuing from a mind blunted by age and misfortune made much sense to me. Sometimes a whole hour of discourse plashed down on me like rain, and I would jot down from it only a single phrase that struck me. Perhaps, "Things cannot be exhausted," or "In the imagination nothing is past, nothing can be forgotten," or "Change is the only valid response to phenomena." I grew aware that Hoffman's phenomenal dynamics involved a hypothetical dialectic between mutability and transformation, the discovery of a certain formula which speeded up the process of mutability, and that he had often spoken to his teacher of a continuous improvisation of correlatives. But for the most part, I was utterly mystified. And I would toast a little cheese on top of the stove to eat with bread and beer for our suppers, Rumble vague, indeterminate sounds, I hoped the old man would interpret as those of a quickened interest, and brood upon the changes I myself had undergone. "Mutable combinations," he would say, swig beer and belch. Then, scooping up a handful of magic samples, he tossed them in the air as in the game of five stones, letting them fall with such solemnity, I was almost tempted to believe, with him, that the haphazard patterns they made as they fell at the blind dictation of chance were echoed in flesh in the beleaguered city, which, he informed me with irritation, was still managing to hold out. Now and then I asked a few questions, though these were mainly concerned with the facts of Hoffman rather than his conceptual framework. Why did he and Mendoza quarrel? "Offer a woman," he said, or so Hoffman once told me, in a voice choked either with tears or with anger. I could not tell which, for by then, of course, I was blind, and reduced to nothing more than a cipher in his formulae. It was a long time before he told me that woman had been the mother of Albertina.
And what happened to Mendoza?
In the end, he spattered himself over infinity in a chromatic arc like a rainbow. Well, nobody would ever know now the cause of the fire that destroyed his itinerant time machine. And then there were my other distractions. Madame Labarbe was as reticent as a young girl. She raised the flap of the tent, deposited her gifts of cake, smoking pots of delicious coffee, and now and then a savory cassoulet on our counter, and vanished with the most fleeting of smiles. Without her beard, she would have been a fat, aproned, hard-mouthed, grim-visaged French countrywoman who never stirred 1/2 kilometer from her native Vie. Bearded, she was immensely handsome, widely traveled, and the loneliest woman in the world. She sat in her caravan and picked out sentimental songs on a parlor organ, crooning the wistful words of love and longing in a high-pitched, over-elocuted voice. Slowly, when she saw I found her neither risible nor disgusting, she started to confide in me. She had only the one dream, to wake up one day in the town where she was born, in her bed of childhood, the geranium on the windowsill, the jug and basin on the washstand, and then die. I found her sympathetic. She exposed her difference to make her living, and had done so for 30 years. Yet each time the gawping peasants came into her booth, as she posed for them in white satin and artificial orange blossom, the bearded bride felt all the pangs of defloration, although, of course, she was a virgin. Each time, she said in her prettily broken accent, a flesh violation. One is penetrated by their eyes. The beard appeared with her breasts. She was 13. Never a pretty girl, always bulky and dowdy. She had hoped only to pass unnoticed. Perhaps a neighboring tradesman in that gray, sedate town in the Loire Valley, where all the chairs wore antimacassars and even the shadows fell with propriety, might marry her for her dot. Her father was a notary. The daughter took her first communion with a blue stubble of 5 o'clock shadow showing under the veil. The mother died of cancer, and the father took to peculation. He was found out. He slit his throat with a common razor. It was an utterly commonplace tragedy. She started to live alone in the echoing narrow house, hiding behind the shutters. She was 15. Soon there was nothing left to sell, and the charity of the neighbors was exhausted. A circus came to town. Trembling in mourning, muffled in veils, she visited the ringmaster, and the next day, she was a working woman. She celebrated her 16th birthday at the carnival in Rio, and had visited in the course of her career all the fabled cities of the world from Shanghai to Valparaiso, Tangiers to Tashkent. It was not her beard that made her unique. It was the fact that never in all her life had she known a single moment's happiness. "This," she would say, touching the frayed leaves of one of her potted plants, "is my monstra deliciosa, my delicious monster." And her eyes would involuntarily stray to the little mirror on the wall. She had fixed one of her black mourning rosettes to its gilt frame. I visited her caravan with great circumspection and never without a small gift. A bunch of violets, candy, a French novel picked up in a second-hand bookstore. In return, she brewed me hot chocolate and played and sang for me. Plaisir d'amour ne dure plus qu'un moment. But she herself had known no pleasure at all. She was a perfect lady. She had the wistful charm of a flower pressed inside a perfectly enormous book. She always used to call me Desiree. It was always refreshingly boring to call on her, like calling on an aunt one had loved very much in childhood. In the oracular limbo between sleeping and waking, my master once cried out, "Everything depends on persistence of vision." Did he refer to the peep show alone, or to the phantoms in the city? I took advantage of his blindness and his sleeps to go through this set of samples and, as far as I could, make a comprehensive catalogue of them. Although this self-imposed inventory was complicated by the difficulty of ascertaining how many samples there were, since the numbers in the sack varied constantly and the work of classifying was almost impossible, because they were never the same if you looked at them twice. I lost the notebooks containing the rough, inadequate list in the earthquake, which, according to Mendoza's theory, was already organizing the events which preceded it with the formal rhetoric of tragedy. And with reference to the landslide, I do not know if I would remember Madame La Barbe as so pitiful, Mamie Buckskin is so ferocious, or my master with such affection, if I did not know with hindsight how soon they were all going to die. However, I remember that, however much the symbolic content of the samples altered, they all came in one of three forms, e.g. A. wax models, often with clockwork mechanisms, as described, B. glass slides, as already described, and C. sets of still photographs, which achieve the effect of movement by means of the technique of the flicker books of our childhood. These sets usually consisted of six or seven different aspects of the same scene, which might be typically a nursemaid mutilating a baby, toasting him over a nursery fire, and then gobbling him up with every appearance of relish. As one moved from machine to machine, watching the various panels of this narrative unfold, each one another facet of the same action, one had the impression of viewing an event in, as it were, temporal depth. The photographs themselves had every appearance of authenticity. I was particularly struck by a series showing a young woman trampled to death by wild horses, because the actress bore some resemblance to Dr. Hoffman's own daughter. There were also pictures of natural catastrophes, such as the San Francisco earthquake, but I did not feel a shudder of anticipatory dread as I handled these. Indeed, I even played through one set of theme and variations upon the subject of an earthquake through the machine when my master was away drinking. And perhaps I should not have meddled with the machines, just as he warned me at that. Though Albertina told me her father always retreated in front of the boundaries of nature, so I do not think I had anything to do with the landslide in reality. From my investigations in the sack, I came to the conclusion that the models did indeed represent everything it was possible to believe by the means of either direct simulation or a symbolism derived from Freud. They were also, or so the peep show proprietor believed, exceedingly numinous objects. He would never let me put them in the machines for him. He had even forbidden me to peek in the bag. "Just let me catch you poking in my sack," he remarked, "and I'll cut your hands off." But I was too cunning to be caught. Mimi Buckskin lived alone in a rifle range. Every morning she set up a row of whiskey bottles along a nearby fence and shot the neck off each one. So she practiced her art. She claimed she could shoot the tail feathers off a pheasant in flight. She claimed she could shoot out the central heart of the Five of Hearts at 20 paces. She claimed she could shoot a specified apple from the bough of a specified tree at 40 paces. And she often lit my cigarettes for me with a single transverse bullet. Her rifles were fire-spitting extensions of her arms, and her tongue also spat fire. She always dressed herself in fringe leather garments of the pioneers of the Old West. Yet her abundant yellow hair was always curled and swept up in the monumental style of the saloon bell, while a very feminine locket contained a picture of her dead alcoholic mother, always bouncing between her lavish breasts. She was a paradox, a fully phallic female with the bosom of a nursing mother and a gun death-dealing erectile tissue perpetually at her thigh. She boasted a collection of more than 50 antique or historic rifles, pistols, and revolvers, including specimens once owned by Billy the Kid, Doc Holliday, and John Wesley Hardin. She spent 3 hours a day polishing them, oiling them, and lovingly fingering each one. She was in love with guns. She was 28 years old and as impervious as if shellacked. Imprisoned in the Far West for shooting the man who held the mortgage when he tried to take possession of her dying father's farm, she easily seduced the jailer, escaped and disposed of the sheriff's posse by shooting them, too. But she soon grew weary of a life of crime, for she was an artist with her weapons. Killing was only an effect of her virtuosity. A Winchester repeater was a Stradivarius to her, and her world was composed only of targets. Sexually, she preferred women. At one time, she had worked a double act in an American burlesque house where, in the trappings of a cowboy hero, she shot every stitch of clothing off her beloved mistress, a fluffy, exuberant blonde of Viennese extraction, whom she had abducted from a convent. But this soubrette ran off with a conjurer and took up a fresh career, in which she was sawn in half nightly. After that, Mamie, made only the more cynical by this brush with love, blazed away by herself. She loved to travel and joined the fair only to see the world. Besides, if she ran her own sideshow, she could keep her hands on all the profits, and next to guns and the open road, she loved money. She took a great liking to me, for she admired passivity in a man more than anything, and she offered me a job as her straight man, to set up her targets and let her blast hats and oranges off my head on stage. But I told her my uncle could not manage without me. Her strident vigor was both exhilarating and exhausting. Now and then, when she could not entice an equestrian into her fur-lined sleeping bag, she morosely made do with me. And these nights were as if spent manning a very small dinghy on a very stormy sea. Her caravan contained nothing but racks of guns, targets, and a tiny, inconspicuous afterthought of a cooking stove, on which she occasionally cooked burning chili and the leaden biscuits she consumed with syrup and a slug of rye for breakfast. Yet sometimes in sleep I surprised her, brass features relaxed. And then she looked once more the wistful belligerent tomboy who stole her father's Colt 45 to roar away at rattlers, but wept when she shot the family German Shepherd in the paw in error. And I occasionally caught her glancing at Madame Labarbe's beard with a certain envy. Mamie, too, was a tragic woman. I see them all haloed in the dark afterlife of accomplished tragedy, moving with the inexorability of the doomed towards a violent death. In the fairground, it was a fact of nature that things were not what they seemed. Mimi once took me to watch the pretty riders servicing the horses in the privacy of the loose box. We lay concealed in the hay as they conjugated the ultimate verb below us. The whinnies we heard could have come from the throats of either the stallions or their riders, and the violence of their movements rocked the box so tempestuously back and forth that at every moment we threatened to fall from our perch. The swaying paraffin lamps which hung from the roof lent a lurid scene a dramatically expressionist chiaroscuro, so intermittent I began to doubt some of the things I saw, and I remember how the peep-show proprietor had muttered in his sleep. It all depends on persistence of vision. Meanwhile, my virile mistress, reeking already with sympathetic lust, pawed and clawed me, so our position was all the more insecure, and in that resounding box of passion, I must admit I did indeed experience Mendoza's durationless infinity. I should say I substantiated his theory, for I have no idea how long the orgy lasted after we did indeed tumble into the morass of satin limbs and flailing hooves, and had there been a clock in the van, I am sure it would have exploded. I was also disturbed because the scene had certainly some resemblances to the sequence of photographs in the sack of samples, showing a girl trampled by horses. Yet it was teasingly different. Even so, I wondered how far I might have prefigured it. Though often, the whole affair seemed only another kind of set of samples anyway. Mamie broke a rib where a horse kicked her, and went about in an unbecoming corselet of bandages for a while. Her eyes, gray as a rifle barrel, took on a curious expression of surmise when she saw me, as though I had revealed unsuspected talents during the evening, and finally she astonished me by offering to teach me how to improve my draw. I discovered the peep-show proprietor was in the habit of performing some kind of divination by means of the samples, though I never found out what it was precisely he divined or forecast, nor how he did it, nor, for that matter, why. Certainly he got no previous information about the landslide from his investigations, or he would have run away. But he would sometimes thrust blindly into the neck of the sack and pull out the first boxes he touched. He would read the braille inscriptions, sometimes with a worried frown, sometimes with shrill squeaks of glee. "To express a desire authentically," he told me, "is to satisfy it categorically." I puzzled over this gnomic utterance for a long time. Did he merely mean what he said, which was patently nonsense? Or was he referring to Mendoza's other theory, that if a thing were artificially enough, it became genuine? I touched his shoulder lightly to waken him for his morning tea, and in his sleep he exhorted, "Objectify your desires." This seemed somehow very important, but I was not at all sure why. The third of my friends, the alligator man, gave me the simplest pleasure. He was a Creole and sometimes played the mouth organ and sang to me rough, dark melodies in a uniquely savorous French. Born in a Louisiana swamp, his affliction was genetic. He owed it to an unhappy interlocking of the genes of his picturesquely fey mother, who rocked all day on the porch in a white nightdress, while her home went to rack and ruin, and his picturesquely crazy father, who spent his time building an ark on the bayou, for he believed the second flood was imminent. The alligator man spent his childhood up to his neck in another part of the same bayou, because he found his own company more stimulating than that of his family, and so lolled all day among the weeds under the drifting ghosts of Spanish moss, playing his harmonica and doing nobody any harm. When he was 12, his father sold him to a traveling showman for the price of 14 pounds of nails, and that was the last he saw of his parents, who did not even bother to wave him goodbye. He spent the rest of his life similarly immersed up to the neck in a glass water tank where he lay somnolently as a log, staring at those who came to stare at him with an unblinking malice. For a man who had spent most of his life underwater, he had a remarkable knowledge of the world and, of all the Fergon people, he was the only one with some inkling of the war or the way in which it was conducted. He and his tank had spent 3 months in a gallery of monsters in the slums of the capital when the hostilities were beginning, and he had grasped to a surprising extent what was going on, though he was as bored by mutability as any immutable stone must be. In his tank he had learned patience, cunning, and duplicity. He had trained himself in the spiritual discipline of absolute apathy. "The freak," he said, "is the norm." He was fond of the peep show and sometimes came out of his tank, leaving a watery trail behind him to visit us. Moving from machine to machine, his flat feet sonorously slapping the ground with a sound of flaccid applause. The scales covered his entire face and body, except for a small patch of infantine softness, pale peach in color, above his genitals, which were perfectly normal. He could not bear the sunlight and had shivering fits if he were out of the water for more than 2 or 3 hours. As far as I could tell, he suffered from no human feelings whatsoever. But I grew very fond of him, for he had refined his subjectivity until he believed in absolutely nothing. He taught me to play the harmonica and finally gave me his very own spare one. I think it was the first gift he had made in his entire life. Though I was very pleased to receive it, I was sorry to see the alligator man's inflexible misanthropy soften a little. So, with one thing and another, life passed pleasantly enough, and I was never bored. The traveling fair tacked back and forth across the uplands, now teasingly taking me high into the foothills and then withdrawing far back almost into the plain. But in his sleep, the peep-show proprietor murmured, "The way south lies along the northern road, and I knew I must leave myself in his hands and dare not hurry things, even when I realized the tentative beginnings of spring were already here." As I drove our ramshackle truck along the rutted roads, I saw the fresh young grass disturbing the drifts of last year's leaves, and Madame La Barbe shyly gave us little bunches of fragile snowdrops, which she crept out to gather in the concealing dusk. It was now 6 months since I'd left the capital, and I still had no means of communicating with the minister.
I tried to telephone his private number from time to time, but all the lines were defunct. Yet I felt a vague stirring in my blood, which was almost the prickings of incipient action, as if I too were awakening with the spring. And now the cavalcade turned incontrovertibly towards the spires of the mountains, and the road began to climb all the time. We were to provide the Easter fair at the highest city in the country, a place where eagles were said to nest in the steeples. Our wheels consumed the pocked asphalt.
"Nebulous time," said the pizza proprietor with a certain anticipatory excitement, "will be succeeded by synthetic time."
However, he did not elaborate on the statement. At the last stop before a destination that would be a terminus for all my companions had they but known it, we were joined by a team of Moroccan acrobats. There were 9 of them and a musician. Yet somehow they all packed themselves neatly into a slickly vulgar motorized trailer in the latest American style, sprayed the luscious pink of plastic orchids, yet ornamented with various Islamic talismans such as black-inked prints of hands to keep away the evil eye. They spoke with others infrequently, and then in a French more dislocated even than the alligator man's, but my French had grown very supple during my conversations with Madame La Barbe, and I managed to gain their confidence sufficiently for them to let me watch them as they rehearsed their extraordinary performance. Although talking to them was like gossiping with hyenas, for they had a slippery viciousness of manner. I was a little afraid of them, even though I thought they were wonderful. All 9 were the same height and shared a similar, almost female sinuosity of spine and marked development of the pectorals. In the daytime, they wore sharp, flared trousers and bright shirts painted with flowers and palm trees, styles more suited to Las Vegas or the Florida beach resorts than to the arid, yellow peaks through which our road now took us. For their stunning gyrations, they donned costumes which might have been designed by Cocteau or Caligula. Brief tunics made of a network of gold crescents with a central projection between the horns, so that amber skin looked netted with hooked freckles. And they did not look clothed at all, only extravagantly naked. A larger half moon hung from the left ear of each of them, and they painted their eyes thickly with kohl, and curled their hair so tightly, their heads looked like bunches of black grapes. They gilded their fingers and toenails and rouged their lips a blackish red. When they were dressed, they negated physicality. They looked entirely artificial. To enter their circular arena was to step directly into the realm of the marvelous. To the weird music of a flute played by a veiled child, they created all the images that the human body could possibly make, an abstract, geometrical dissection of flesh that left me breathless. When I told the peep show proprietor about them, he cursed his blindness. "The acrobats of desire have come," he said. "Nebulous time is almost upon us." But they had never even heard the name Hoffman. Although 4 times a day they transcended their own bodies and made of themselves plastic anagrams, I suspected an arrangement of mirrors. I inspected their arena and found nothing but sawdust in which ashed half-moons glittered here and there. Their act went something like this. A clumsy spotlight focused on their minuscule sawdust ring. F. The flute wailed a phrase. A faint tintinnabulation of their metallic shifts heralded their coming. They entered one by one. First, they formed a simple pyramid, 3, 3, 2, and 1.
Then they reversed themselves and formed the pyramid upside down, one on his hands, whose feet supported two, and so on. Their figures flowed into one another so choreographically, it was impossible to see how they extricated or complicated themselves. They did not